This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Freddie.
And I'm Ben.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast. This is an episode we like to call You Ask Us. If you'd like to submit a question, please visit newstatesman.com/You Ask Us or leave a comment on YouTube. I'm Anoush Shakelian, Britain editor of The New Statesman and host of this podcast, and I'm joined in the studio by our political correspondent, Freddie Haywood. And joining us down the line from Chester is Ben Walker, our senior data journalist and polling expert. Now, I'm actually going to go first on the questions this week because the other day I was contacted by someone who I think might be our youngest listener. Casper, who is 13 and listens to every episode of The New Statesman podcast, sent me an 104-page Labour manifesto he and his two friends wrote and designed themselves. And yes, Rachel Reeves, if you're listening, it is fully costed. I was really impressed by his commitment and we had a nice chat, and he sent in a question. He asks, is there a growing need for a new political party in the UK, and how possible is it to win? We've seen Macron's party in France, the Farmers' Party in the Netherlands, and I'm sure there's more. Even with first past the post, can a new party get the support needed and win a decent amount of seats? This is a really good question, and I think a lot of our younger listeners will think, why? Why are we trapped in this strange two-party system? Mm-hmm. And why do, in most of the country, in the safe seats that we're voting in, we have very little influence over the election result? So, Ben, why don't you give us a little summary of why it's so difficult for smaller parties, even the established ones, to break through in this kind of voting system?
Just a little summary. During the Brexit wars, we saw a lot of attempts to set up new political parties, and they all got off the ground for about 10 minutes on Twitter, on Facebook, and then they failed very quickly. This is the thing with political parties, and if you don't mind, I'd like to give a little bit of a personal anecdote for some of you who may know. I'm now a borough councillor, majority 1,833.
Net worth.
I was made a candidate last year back in March. And my ward, the ward that I represent, is 18,000 people, 11,000 voters. And the thing in Chester is we campaign every week. We gave it a pretty intense campaign, even as well when we had the by-election here as well. And I noticed that, you know, since I became a candidate and once it came to election day, though there were 11,000 voters, we only were able to speak to, I think it was like 4,000 people. So 4,000 out of 11,000, that's not a lot. And by the way, that is actually 4,000 conversations, you know, marking how you're intending to vote, what your passions are, problems, you're going to back me, so on and so forth. I don't think anyone realizes the reach you need to have to break through to voters, to break through to people, because the turnout in my ward was 30% and I got 52%. So what's that? I got 15% of the electorate voting for me. That's fine in a local election, but it's not anything to really shout home about. And so yes, reach is absolutely important. If you had an intense campaign, you're only going to reach, I don't know, about a third to potentially even half of your electorate, because you need the foot soldiers, you need the ground campaign. And you need to also recognize that you could talk to as many people as you want, but what you're used to doing matters more. It's all about behavior. What's going to change your behavior, right? If your polling station is changed, if it's in a different direction, if it's a different place, your behavior is going to change. And how many voters are going to be turned off by that? If you've got a new party, how many of you are just going to stick to what you know? Better the devil you know than the devil you don't, really. And that's what I think sort of leads it on. But to be specific about the question, why don't we have another political party? Because there's always an appetite for one. There's always an appetite. It's not just policies. The Greens like to say, oh, we've got the most popular policies in the country. It is about personality. It is about brand. It is about, do you trust them? Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party instance always pointed to their popular policies. But did voters trust Jeremy Corbyn to implement them without crashing the building down? Very few voters did. And that's why he never really had as much cut through as possible. Now, this is a long-winded way of getting around the question. But the truth is, you have long established prejudices in voters in the country that by the way, campaigning won't unpick. Because just to reiterate, I only spoke to about a third of my electorate. And brand, press game, you know, the press is centred in Westminster. They're centred in SW1. They're centred where, you know, power is, rightly. How are you going to break into that unless you have something that is both top down and ground up? You need like tens of thousands of activists to be ground up, and you need parliamentary backing to be top down. And no one has ever really had that. Change UK had some MPs from the Labour Party, one or two from the Tories as well, but they had nothing in terms of a ground campaign. Very few activists came over. I think about a dozen councillors went their way. The Greens, however, are something different. They've got the ground campaign. They don't have a top-down media war. And what you're seeing is they're having a bottom-up surge, which is why they're winning council seats, but they're not doing anything nationally. So, yeah, you need two bottom-up and top-down things, really. And it takes a lot of effort.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with the rules of our broadcasters as well. Yeah. So you've got to have a certain amount of representation to earn yourself a certain amount of time, you know, for the BBC to dedicate to you, for example. So it's very difficult to break through into the media ecosystem as well as break through that first past the post system as well.
Yeah, completely. I think we have to, first of all, talk about first past the post. That's the key reason. If we look, for instance, at 2015, how well UKIP did, they got 3.8 million votes, and they ended up with, was it one seat, I think? So there's a large disproportionality there, which favours the two main parties and makes it extremely difficult for third parties to break through. You saw it the same with the 1983 election, when the alliance between the SDP and the Liberal Party led to, I think it was between 20 and 25% of votes, but they only got 23 seats. So there's a huge disparity there, which basically blocks off third parties from entering the House of Commons, and that leads to all of the other benefits: the money, the media attention, the time of Prime Minister's questions, the offices, all of it, if you don't have seats in the House of Commons. It's one of the reasons, I think, why UKIP and other small parties found it so helpful to have MEPs, because it means you've got people who have a salary, they have offices, they have expenses. It just allows a party to function. And then the other thing worth noting is just the sheer dominance of the two major parties of the past 100 years or so. We have to remember that it was in the early 20th century, the Liberals and the Conservatives that ruled the roost, and then we had the collapse of the Liberals in the following the First World War and during the 1920s. And then since then, it's been largely the Labour and the Conservative Party. And what they've both done extremely well is co-opt issues that are profit or, you know, seized upon by fringe parties and other groups within society. They're both, as parties, quite broad churches who are able to see where politics is going and move towards that, especially the Conservative Party. Look what David Cameron did in the late noughties about co-opting the green agenda, about moving towards more socially liberal values. He saw where Tony Blair was and he moved towards that. And similarly, in the 2010s, he tried to shut down UKIP and its successes by offering his backbenchers a referendum. So I think both of the two main parties are quite aware of the fact that they need to maintain their own position within the political system by co-opting issues and debates that other third parties raise.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, because both of the main parties are broad churches, and that is also a result of first past the post. They have to be coalitions in their own right. And I think that's why some of these so-called centrist parties that sprung up since Brexit, because before Brexit, you did have a few sort of people trying to make new parties, but they were usually for local issues, things like Cornish independence and other kind of things. Whereas these more nationally focused new parties sprung up after Brexit for the kind of homeless centrist voters who felt that they weren't represented by either party. I remember going out campaigning with Renew. You mentioned Renew, Ben, which formed in 2018, I think. And I remember going out on the road with them in Milton Keynes, and just people were just so baffled by who they were. I mean, you could just see that it was just an impossible operation. But the reason why I think that those kind of groups, there was another one, Advance Together, founded after Grenfell, they don't catch on because most of their sort of bugbears are represented somewhere within the major two parties. And that is another symptom of first past the post as well. But I think that, you know, these smaller groups, these pressure groups, if you like, do have that means they do have an outsized influence on parties. So you saw, obviously, UKIP with the Brexit referendum is the big example. But look at what happened. I mean, our questioner was asking about international examples. Look at what happened with the Teal candidates in the Australian election, the most recent Australian election, this kind of loosely aligned group of independent kind of community rooted politicians who were focused on climate. And they, you know, they were pivotal. I mean, they stood in these safe Liberal Party seats and they won six of them, and they changed the conversation around that election in favour of the Labour Party, which did win power. So there is a lesson there, I think, to be learned. Change UK, similarly, I mean, people laughed at them. These were the people who defected from the main parties to form this anti-Brexit kind of group. They did actually really influence Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn was spooked by them. He changed Labour's Brexit line in 2019 to one that supported a second referendum. And that, you know, had huge political consequences.
Yeah, and yeah, it's worth re-looking at Brexit and how it ripped apart politics and opened up all these little gaps that new parties could try and fill. I mean, that's why you had the Brexit Party, and that's why it did so well back in 2019, when they had that big surge before the locals and then in the European election that year as well. And then what you basically saw is those gaps got filled. Conservatives left the European Union. Keir Starmer's clamped down on speculation about their Europe position. They don't really want to talk about it before the next general election. So it's no longer an issue that third parties can talk about. It's one of the reasons Reform is doing so badly, as we've often spoken about. They don't have that unifying issue that Brexit was. They now talk about, they spend lots of their time talking about conspiracy theories and monetary policy reform and immigration and public sector reform. I mean, some of them are important issues, some of them aren't. But they aren't filling a big gap in the market because people aren't looking for something. And they're getting, broadly, I think, they're getting what they want from the two main parties.
Yeah, and they're fishing in the same pool as another small party that we have at the moment, the Reclaim Party.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like the UKIP for culture, is how they build themselves. But they are sort of trying to drum up that populist, I mean, I would argue slightly conspiracy-minded sort of section.
Under Lawrence Fox.
Yeah, under Lawrence Fox. And again, you can see that the audience for that is small numerically, but it does sort of have an outsized kind of echo around social media and some of the preoccupations of some politicians on the right of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and someone we've not mentioned yet is the SNP. The SNP aren't one of the two main parties.
Yeah.
But if you look at their influence on UK politics in the past 15 or 20 years or so, it's been massive. They are the ones who secured a referendum back in 2014. And then it also, when just thinking about that and thinking about devolution in general, there are other opportunities for parties that aren't the two big ones to come forward. And then also we must mention Northern Ireland and the disparate group of parties. So there are opportunities for smaller parties to get into office and actually hold proper power.
Mm. And ALBA too, as well, yeah, in Scotland. I mean, another pro-independence party, Alex Salmond, a very big figure, they've managed to rattle the SNP establishment with their different line on gender recognition, on a stronger line on pushing for a referendum. They had, you know, a bit of an influence in that leadership contest, you know, sticking their oar in. Suggesting to the SNP that they unite ahead of the next election. So, you know, these parties, even though they may remain small, they can have an influence on leaders' decisions. After the break, Freddie will introduce his question. So give us a clue on what that's on, Freddie.
It's potentially a tricky one for Andy Burnham again.
If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all of our episodes ad-free on The New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back after this.
If you enjoy the New Statesman podcast, then you'll love our daily politics newsletter, Morning Call. It's a quick, essential guide to the big political story each morning by me, Freddie Hayward and Rachel Weirmouth, featuring original reporting from Westminster and beyond, our analysis of the latest political news, and some recommendations of the best reads of the day. Sign up for free at the link in the podcast description.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, Freddie, so what's your question?
Okay, it's a question from Tom in London. He asks, why is Andy Burnham not in more hot water over scandals and failings at Greater Manchester Police?
Okay, this is a really important question. I'm glad that Tom sent it in. Three women have made claims about Greater Manchester Police, with one saying she was drugged and sexually assaulted during her detention by the police in 2021. There are 2 hours of footage that have gone missing from the period of detention. And the force has denied withholding that footage. And Andy Burnham, as Greater Manchester Mayor, he is the police commissioner for this force. He's ordered a review of these cases. I think this is a really important story, not just because of the allegations at hand, but because of the way that we see our police forces are run. So who do we think is head of Manchester Police? Do we see it as Andy Burnham, or do we see it as the police chief? In the struggles of the Met, Sadiq Khan has often come under pressure. And you can see in London campaigns, often his Conservative and other opponents will sort of pin any problems with crime and any problems within the police force on his mayoralty, because he is, again, as mayor, the commissioner. Is there a problem with the sort of accountability, the lines of accountability here in terms of our police?
Yeah, I think there are. I think it's slightly confused. If you look at Sadiq Khan, it's often he and the Home Secretary are pointing at each other going, it's your fault and it's not my fault. In part, that's a symptom of the Met Police having national responsibilities, the counter-terrorism and things like that, alongside policing London itself. But it is an interesting question. I think it's a great question. I think just mentioning Sadiq Khan, as we both have done, immediately just highlights how often the media, and us as well, probably also just focus on the Met. I think it's because we're all in London, but then also because it's also the national functions that they also hold. But, you know, Manchester is the second biggest police force in the country, I think. And they've had a series of problems. They went into special measures, I think it was back in 2020, after they didn't record 1 in 5 crimes for a period of a year. So there was a number of failings that they were put in special measures for. And then they did improve. They did get taken out of special measures back in October 2022, and they recovered on a large number of metrics, including response times and things like that, quite quickly. But in terms of accountability, I think it's super, super interesting. Police and crime commissioners, they were brought in 2011 by the coalition government. And the idea was that you'd have this elected person who was responsible for the police. What does that mean? It means that they appoint the chief constable. It means they're responsible for their budget. It also means that they set their overall policing strategy. You know, what sort of crime do you want to focus on? Where do you want to put the money? And the idea, was to give the public a lever to pull to influence how their area was policed. But we've not really seen that. And I think one of the problems is that we've had such a low turnout for all of these police and crime commissioner elections. Often it's around 15%. So it's very hard to say that the electorate or constituents are holding the police and crime commissioner and indirectly the police to account if no one's actually voting in those elections. So what you've seen since then, and since around 2013 onwards, when we had all the discussions about Metro mayors, is that the police and crime commissioners have been subsumed into the Metro mayoralties. So Andy Burnham effectively has that role now as part of his role as Manchester Mayor. So I think there is a slight confusion. Andy Burnham can call for a review, and he can try and hold the chief constable to account, because he can ultimately get rid of them. But it's really tricky. And I think the devolved administrations do it in different ways, and I don't think anyone would admit that it's gone particularly well in the past 10 years.
Yeah, I do think this is a sort of wider lesson about devolution in general, which is, you know, both main parties want to devolve more power. They kind of talk about it as this catch-all solution to local problems. Yeah. But actually, you do get a too many cooks situation. I mean, the policing example is a perfect example of that. You have the Home Secretary, you have the mayor in some places, you have the Police and Crime Commissioner in the places without metro mayoralties, you have the police chief themselves. Mm. In the end, it means that a lot of people can point the blame at other people, and actually, you know, what's right for victims falls through all of these stalls. I remember speaking to Ian Blair, who was Met Commissioner in the new Labour years, and he said that he felt like one man, two governors, you know, that play one man, two governors, because he had the Home Secretary on one side and he had the London Mayor on the other side. And, you know, they were often trying to take credit for the things that the Met were doing well and blame each other for the failings. And I think we've seen a lot of that with the situation of Sadiq Khan in London. And actually, I mean, these police and crime commissioners, who, according to the people that I've spoken to when I've been reporting on the police, have taken away some of that accountability, because you don't get as many police chiefs on the airwaves, you know, on media doing interviews, taking responsibility for their force's mistakes as you used to, because you now have this extra layer and it's basically like an evasive politician being interviewed again, rather than someone who actually knows what's going on in their force on the ground. That apparently has been a big change over the past, I mean, when were they first voted in 2012? Mm-hmm. So over the past, over a decade of having these PCCs in. And actually, Labour has toyed with getting rid of this system over the years as well.
Yeah, and as we discussed back in Crime Week, I can't remember when it was, but it was Labour.
Every week is Crime Week in Britain.
And yeah, one of their key things is they want to regulate the system by which police forces are held to account. At the moment, Labour is complaining about the fact that individual police forces have individual standards, and they want to standardise all of that so we get a greater understanding of what police forces are up to. So yeah, they're very aware of it, and I think Yvette Cooper's team and Labour in general are definitely looking at police forces and how they're regulated and how we hold them to accountable quite closely.
I think that's really important, because if you look at the case of these three women who were strip searched, this was in 2021. This was in the period of special measures. Mm. Special measures is supposed to be a period of heightened scrutiny. So, I mean, we don't know what's happened in this case, but when we do know the details, there may be questions to be answered on why this wasn't picked up at the time. But Ben, can you give us a bit of an idea, because we've been talking about PCCs, Freddie mentioned the low turnout. How much voter engagement is there really with these elections? And has it sort of waxed and waned over the years since they were introduced?
Yeah, so they were introduced back in 2012. And I think the first election for them, I remember, because I was in high school at the time, first election for them was in the middle of November 2012. And the turnout back then was around about 15 or so percent, which was astonishing. It was ridiculously low. That's lower than anything we normally get in local elections. And then we fast forwarded to 2016, and turnout decided to start to rise. And I don't want to say voters got normalized to the idea of voting in PCC elections, but more people were engaging with them. So we went up from an average of about 15 to 20% to around about 25% in 2016 in the PCC election. It was getting closer to 30%, 25 to 30%. So we are, runs contrary to some narratives. We are seeing greater engagement in it. Now, bear in mind, in local council elections, turnout is normally around about 35%. So a PCC vote, you know, hovering around 30, that's still subpar for our standard engagements with local contests, I suppose. And Andy Burnham, when he first stood for the Greater Manchester mayoralty, won very convincingly, more than Labour normally ever wins in Greater Manchester, but only on a turnout of 29%. In 2021, it was a turnout of 35%. So you can see a big increase, despite, by the way, 2021 was held in the immediate aftermath of lockdown. So I think over time, institutions do get normalised to voters. We do tend to, vote in what we've known has existed for however long. And we are seeing that in mayoralties. We are slowly seeing that with PCC votes, though I still, for the life of me, can't understand why we have them. In the case of Burnham, though, in the case of Burnham, and I wonder why he's not getting enough flack or as much stick as perhaps he should. Let's say if it was, you know, Sadiq Khan down in London or in Scotland. I think it comes down to the fact that we can't measure the public attention on it, although we could try to. But is Burnham being associated with it in the eyes of the public? We don't really know. I'm minded to suspect no. And I just want to give a little example here. So 2020, lockdown, first one. We were freed for a little while in July, in the summer months, I suppose. And across the whole of the UK, lockdown laws were pretty much the same until we moved to that tier system, if you remember that horrid tier system. And in that period of time, Boris Johnson saw his numbers rise and plateau quite a little bit. And I always remember this. In Scotland, if you asked Scots, who do you think is handling COVID well? Very few Scots said Boris Johnson, but lots of Scots obviously said Nicola Sturgeon. And it's worth bearing in mind, at that time when that poll was asked, there was no difference in policy between Sturgeon and Johnson. It was all about what, you know, your own personal prejudices. Let's not beat around the bush. Voters are prejudiced. If Sturgeon does the same thing as Johnson does, I'll say Sturgeon did it brilliantly and Johnson did it terribly. A lot of voters are willing to do that. They're very much like that. And I suspect maybe if we were to measure the public opinion element of this in Greater Manchester with relation to Mr. Burnham, I suspect, one, voters aren't clued up enough to know it falls under Burnham's purview. And two, I don't think voters will necessarily care, because they probably view it's a nationwide institutional problem that needs to be sorted down in Westminster. I just don't think voters associate the bad things with their local leaders as much as they do with Westminster. Although, bear in mind, the third most unpopular tax in the country is council tax. So actually, I do think if you're looking to bash a local politician, it will obviously be a local council. But a local mayor, not always.
Yeah, that's another layer that I forgot to mention, is the local council separate from the mayor's office. Thanks, Ben, and thanks, Freddie. And thank you to everyone who submitted questions. We do read them all, so please keep them coming in. If you'd like to send us a question, you can go to newstatesman.com/youaskus, or if you're watching on YouTube, just leave a comment under the video. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Kellyan, and my colleagues, Freddie Haywood and Ben Walker. Tomorrow, we're bringing you a reflective audio long read from the author and climate journalist George Monbiot, who shares how he manages to keep positive while reporting on the climate crisis. Follow us on your podcast app to make sure you get new episodes as soon as they're released. You can also watch video from this podcast on our YouTube channel. Just search YouTube for The New Statesman. This episode is produced by Matt Murphy, and the executive producer is Chris Stone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.